You're listening to Consider This on KZYX. My name is Stuart Campbell, and I welcome you to the program. We're on the web at considerthis.us, where you can sign up to receive email updates about future programs. We're also on the KZYX website, and you can get information about future, current, and past programs, and listen to or download podcasts of past shows at both locations. You can call us here in the studio a little later on in the program at 707-895-2448, or you can send your comments or questions at any time to dj@kzyx.org. My guest on this program is Columbia University philosophy professor Philip Kitcher. He's the author of numerous books, including Life After Faith, The Case for Secular Humanism, and Philosophy of Science, A New Introduction. Most recently, he and his co-author Evelyn Fox Keller have written The Seasons Alter, How to Save Our Planet in Six Acts, in which they present the realities of global warming in the most human terms, everyday conversation, showing us how to convince skeptics why we need to act now. Philip Kitcher, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to take part in it.
So you've written this book as a series of dialogues, primarily exploring the kinds of conversations that real people might have about this issue. Generally, your characters in these dialogues, you have two, they kind of change who they are, but use just two names. They tend to be on opposing sides of the issue. Only the first one of the six is what we might call a climate skeptic. The others represent a variety of concerns and different themes, and I'd like to at least touch on as many of those as we can in this hour. But first, one thing that really struck me in your conversational approach in this book is the real need to listen respectfully to the different voices, the different perspectives on this issue, particularly maybe when engaging those with whom you might be on opposite sides. And if I'm correct in getting that sense of that that's really something you're going for in the book, I'd like you to talk about that and expand on it, and kind of if you could maybe talk about why you thought that was really something that needed to be brought to this issue.
Well, I think it probably at the moment needs to be brought to many issues. We're unfortunately living in a very politically polarized country, and the rhetoric is often inflammatory, sometimes even violent. And I don't think we're going to get very far on the important issues that confront us, including what I think of as an extraordinarily important issue, how to confront climate change, unless we stop ignoring one another, shouting one another down, and try to understand what's moving our fellow citizens. It does seem to me, and it seems to my co-author Evelyn Keller, that what we need is a return to a kind of person-to-person interaction and conversation in which people can come together, work through their differences, and try to find solutions to serious problems. And that's really what we tried to do in the book. We're trying to show how you can talk respectfully, even lovingly, to people with whom you disagree. And that, I guess, at a time when we're so polarized and we think that all we can do is shout our own opinions at one another and try to muscle and outvote people with whom we disagree, what democracy requires, urgently requires, is more listening and more attempt at mutual understanding.
As you say, in this particular political climate, that's really a challenge. And I know you finished writing this book before the election of Donald Trump and before his pulling us out of the Paris Climate Agreement.
Indeed.
So I think we need to start by just talking about that a bit.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when we were writing the book, we were encouraged. We don't think that the Paris Agreement of 2015 was adequate, but it was a great start. It seemed a sign of hope. Finally, the United States, under the Obama administration, was leading the way. And then came the Trump phenomenon, and it's not just that Trump has pulled us back from that, but it seems to me that he's further divided the country and further inflamed the public conversation. And of course, with Scott Pruitt at the EPA, much of the valuable work that was being done towards the end of the Obama administration is being reversed. I have to say, though, that your own state, California, is quite encouraging. In fact, the West Coast is quite encouraging in this regard, in that there is a dedication. Your governor has shown this to trying to move forward. And there does seem to be much more unity on environmental issues in the far western part of the country. So that's an encouraging thing. But this needs to be not only a national effort, it needs to be an international effort. And we wrote the book in hopes of trying to foster a grassroots movement in which people would come together and try to understand the range of the problems that arise here and try to reach agreement on policies that are needed for resolving them.
So to follow on this theme of really trying to listen to and understand people on the different sides of this issue, in this first chapter of the six, you do present a dialogue, one of the people in the dialogue is a climate skeptic. And so you do get a bit into why somebody might occupy that position. Like one of the points that I think you made, and I'd like you to expand on this, and anything else that you can kind of show to try to get a sense of how to understand it. People wouldn't have a kind of a normal natural resistance to anything where they're being told that their lifestyle is going to have to change dramatically and might have profound impacts on them.
That's right. Okay, so look, I want to actually say that in all of six of the dialogues, or all six of the chapters, there are people who are climate deniers in some sense. Okay, so the first chapter is about someone who says, look, is this a real phenomenon? The second chapter is about someone who thinks it's a real phenomenon but thinks it doesn't matter much. The third chapter is about someone who thinks that it's a real phenomenon and that it matters, but that the plight of people in the present is something that we ought to address first. The fourth one is about somebody who thinks, yeah, we should take it seriously, we should plan for the future, but there's not much we can do. And the fifth one is somebody somebody who thinks that there are things that we can do, but they're going to be too costly. And the sixth one is somebody who thinks, well, yes, there are things we can do, and all of these, all the previous arguments are right, but we just can't get the political will together to do it. So, I mean, you've got, in a certain sense, an ever more attenuated form of climate denial. But the first guy is the guy who thinks, and I think this is a very reasonable point, you know, there's dissent about whether this phenomenon is actually happening, and if we start thinking that it is happening, then we're going to have to do something about it, and that means people are going to have to change their lives, and that's going to be quite consequential for them. So, he says, with some reason, when you want me to make real changes in the way I behave, you better be pretty sure it's right. The standards of evidence really go up. And he's not actually so much a denier as agnostic about it. He says, well, you know, maybe it's happening, maybe it isn't, but the jury's out, and you've got to produce more and better evidence. And so his counterpart, who is in fact his wife of many years, tries to lay out for him the evidence. And he says, yeah, I can see how it goes in general, but how do I know that they haven't made mistakes? Or how do I know that these are people we should trust? And those, I think, are the two main things that fuel this kind of climate skepticism. The thought that, you know, there's some mistake in the scientific community, or there's some point of contention within the scientific community about the technical details. That's the first thing. Or that there is some kind of conspiracy. I mean, our president has talked about a hoax or something that's been manufactured in China or somewhere else. And so it's the old question, you know, are they fools or are they knaves? Are they deliberately trying to deceive us, or are they people who, you know, can't get their act together and really figure out what's happening? And those, I think, are serious questions, and they need to be addressed. I think when you actually look at them head on, they're not that difficult to resolve. And that's why I think of this first form of climate skepticism as actually a relatively easy problem to solve. The really hard ones are the ones that come later.
Well, I have to say, though, that there is, as far as I can tell, and you're pretty much preaching to the choir up here in Northern California. You already indicated California is kind of ahead of a curve on some of the rest of the, with some of the rest of the country, but there is a lot of misinformation. There is a lot of this kind of skepticism, a lot of this kind of lack of understanding of the issue, and the political debate doesn't seem to be handling it. Are you suggesting really in this conversational approach that this, a big part of how this needs to go is that people everywhere need to be having these kind of more personal conversations with one another in order to move the dial?
Yeah, and so we wrote the book as dialogue, but we also included in the notes at the end lots and lots of references and places people can go to get information. And so we're trying to sort of provide the opportunity for groups of people to get together. I mean, possibly groups as small as two, possibly bigger groups, and try to work these things through. I mean, people should actually look at the temperature graphs that have been constructed by the experts in the field. They should look at the couple of thousand year graph that goes back. You know, that this is Michael Mann's hockey stick graph, and which has been confirmed and corroborated by a number of independent experts and has been very, very seriously scrutinized and discussed. They should look at that. They should look at the very long-term graphs of temperature on our planet, and then they should look at the graphs of carbon dioxide and its equivalents concentrations in the atmosphere. And what you see, of course, and we reproduce one of this in the book, is that these things, you know, march along in synchrony with one another. Now, once you see that, it seems to me, you've got to ask, well, let's assume that the work has been done accurately. Okay, first of all, let's just assume that. What explains that? What is it that makes it the case that the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and other gases like methane in the atmosphere, why does that go along so consistently tracking the Earth's temperature in the way that it does? And then people should learn about this very, very basic bit of physics and chemistry established in the 19th century, which is the greenhouse effect. This is something that nobody should have any doubts about. When they get to that point, they should start thinking, well, is there something else going on? I mean, besides the greenhouse effect. The greenhouse effect is plainly responsive to things that we do, to our emissions of various gases into the atmosphere. But maybe there's something else going on. And so they should then look at the efforts of climate scientists and the reports of these efforts to see whether other things make a difference. And it turns out that they don't. So that throws the whole burden back onto whether or not the work has been done accurately. And at this point, it seems to me that, you know, you've got a huge international community that's been, you know, looking at this very, very carefully for, 30, 40 years now. And, yeah, they could have made a mistake, just as physicists or chemists or biologists can make a mistake in other disciplines. But you don't go around in running your life on the basis of skepticism about, you know, the things your doctor tells you, because the science behind it might be wrong. At least you shouldn't do that. So if it's not, if this area of science is just as reliable as physics and chemistry and biology and other areas, is it the case that there's been some global conspiracy? And we think that that's, if you take that idea seriously for a moment, you know, how do you get the entire international scientific community to agree about something? I mean, the incentives for a young climate scientist to lay out in detail the case why climate change is a myth would be enormous. This isn't the mafia we're dealing with. This is a bunch of people who are often highly ambitious and highly independent and not under the control of any particular boss or any particular country.
Right.
And on the other side, you've got, as Naomi Oreskes has documented, you know, now for nearly a decade, what you've got are a whole bunch of people who are paying various spokesmen who are typically in different fields to come forward and sort of blow smoke. And that, what's going on there is clearly, industry fostered and industry paid for research. So, I mean, you know, you shouldn't be in any more doubt about this than you are about whether smoking is bad for your health.
Right. Still seems to be a bit of a challenge to convince some people of that, and maybe the approach is to, on a case-by-case basis, smaller groups, as you say, really engage in kind of personal conversation and really try to understand and listen to the other side. I want to move on to kind of the next couple of chapters a little bit. Again, I think you're preaching a bit to the choir up in here, so we may not have to go through a lot of this. But in the second chapter, one of the themes is, you know, okay, so climate change is happening, but really, so what? So you take a world tour of some of the effects. And again, I don't think we need to go through all of them. I think they're pretty well known by a lot of my listeners. But I also like, in the very beginning, you kind of present a fanciful dystopian view of what things might look like. Maybe that would be another tool in the toolkit in having conversations with people.
Yeah, well, I think the dystopia brings out something that I think isn't widely appreciated. I mean, people tend to look at these phenomena one by one. They tend to say, okay, so how much has the sea level gone up? Now, notice what that kind of question immediately looks at. It looks at an average effect. Well, as we've just been seeing this past week, it's not actually the averages, it's the extremes that count. And, of course, as you raise the average, you raise the extremes. And, indeed, climate scientists think you may actually tilt things even further, because there are suggestions that you're going to get so-called fat tails in the distribution, really extreme events coming with significant probabilities. Okay, so you've got these what we call in the book episodic effects of climate change, things like droughts and wildfires and heat waves and storms and floods and so forth. Okay, but those shouldn't be considered in isolation from one another. I mean, it's not just that the floods happen and the droughts happen. It's that these things occur in connection with one another. So you get, perhaps in some region of the world, a region of acute drought and relatively nearby, a region of acute flooding or a region of high, you know, fires and heat waves and things like that. And now all of these people are displaced. They're struggling to get the few resources that remain. There are existing social and political tensions among them. They can't keep themselves clean. They're extremely dehydrated. This is a wonderful opportunity for new forms of disease to break out, for diseases to be transmitted. It's a great opportunity for wars to break out. It's a very conjectural business, but many people have begun to suggest that that various wars that have conflicts that have occurred recently in the Near East have had a climate change component, that the drying up of existing water sources is exacerbating old political and social tensions. So it seems to me it's very important to put all these things together. You say, well, the sea has only risen by so much. That's not so bad. But it's not the sea rising per se. It's the storms that come with it. And it's not just the storms on their own. It's the storms as they interact with all sorts of other climatic phenomena and agricultural phenomena and political and social phenomena. So this is a much more dire situation than I think you appreciate if you just simply say, well, you know, the sea's going to rise a little bit.
Right.
So I need to make sure I'm safely above the average water level. No. That's not the deep problem.
Right. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Consider This on KZYX. I'm your host, Stuart Campbell. My guest is Philip Kitcher, author most recently of The Seasons Alter, How to Save Our Planet in Six Acts.
Co-author.
Yes. Keller, I think is her last name, right?
Evelyn Keller.
Evelyn Keller, right. So it occurs to me, if I'm trying to look at it from the other side, and you're talking a little bit about this dystopian view, how would you respond to what I anticipate might be some kind of a response, like, you're just fear-mongering?
Yeah. Well, the truth of the matter is that a certain amount of worry is productive. You don't go through life, typically, when you're running your family affairs, ignoring the challenges, say, that your children are going to face. You have to recognize that there are many, many things that could affect their lives if you live in certain parts of the world or in certain parts of this country. And you don't know that these things are going to happen, but sometimes you know that there are possibilities for danger. You can't put probabilities on those. But you would be incredibly irresponsible if you didn't take those seriously. So if you live in, say, in one of the more dangerous parts of Chicago, right, and you're relatively poor, it would be silly to think that your children are somehow can wander around the streets and with some guardian angel will sit on their shoulder and make sure that they don't run into awful situations that could lead to real damage for them, or even to their deaths. You have to be thoughtful about things, even when you can't quantify the probabilities very well. And that's just part of being a responsible guardian yourself of people you care about and of the future. And that seems to us to be the right kind of attitude to look towards the future. We know that there are all sorts of dire scenarios that are possible for the human future in the next century, in the next two centuries. We know they're possible. We don't know how probable they are. And that's a bit like the parent in the rundown section of a major city who knows that certain kinds of things could happen to the children on their way to school. And so you take steps to try to protect against the worst things that could happen. That's what being responsible is. And it seems to us that you've got to face up to the potential dangers.
Right.
There's a voice that says, well, maybe it won't happen. The trouble is that if it does happen, it's disastrous. And there's a significant chance that something bad could easily happen during the course of your child's growing up, and there's a significant chance that something really, really bad could happen to our in the world that our children and grandchildren will inhabit.
So let's move on into, because you're preaching to the choir here pretty much about the status of it and the dangers of it. So another part of the second half of the book, maybe in the second chapters, are about, okay, what can we do about it? And one of the things that struck me about dealing with kind of the technological aspect of this, because there is, I've had people on the show before who said, look, we're not going to technologize our way out of this, but it certainly is part of the answer. And I liked the theme you have of that, look, that all has to be kind of experimental. We have to do it broadly, and we have to do it trying things out, see how they work, be in communication with each other about what's working and what's not. So if you talk just briefly about that, I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, I think this kind of pragmatism is something that is desperately needed in the climate discussions that we're having. I mean, the temptation is for human beings to want to have a plan that they can be pretty much guaranteed in advance is going to succeed, or at least have high chances of success. That's what we all want. And the answer is, in this area, we don't have that. We don't really know what will work and what won't. Maybe technology will help us. Maybe in 30 years' time, we will look back at this particular era and say, well, it was actually soluble, and we managed to solve it because we learned how to sequester carbon, even to suck carbon out of the atmosphere. There was a brilliant technological breakthrough and it worked. You don't want to put all your eggs in that basket, though. You want to try other things too, because if we don't get that technological solution and we don't do anything else, then our descendants will really, really suffer. So you want to try and see the extent to which you can replace fossil fuels with renewable sources of energy. This is something which has gone on, I mean, it's gone on wonderfully in certain parts of the country, including California. When we wrote the book, the figure I had was that there were twice as many people installing solar panels in the United States as there were active coal miners. That's completely out of date now. There are now four times as many solar panel installers as there are coal miners. And it seems to me that that's really something that we should be trying to explore on a much larger scale, but it's not the only thing. We should also be thinking about what we really, really want and need to do. Do we need super big houses? Do we need sort of gilded palaces in which people can advertise what they conceive of as their successes? What's really important in people's lives? How do we make sure we sustain that? And so it seems to us that the best way to think about this is to think of ourselves as, and we use this image in the book, as if we were lost in a wood. And there are some things we know that about finding our way out. We know it's good to look for light through the trees, but we don't know which of those potential glimmerings of light through the trees might lead us to safety. So if there are a lot of us, it would be good if we could try a large number of them and see what leads us in promising directions. And so that's what we really try to recommend, this try it out and see what works. But while you're trying it out, you've got to cooperate with one another. That is, you've got to protect people whose experiments go badly. And you've got to make available to all the experiments that go well. And that really leads to many of the themes in the second half of the book, where we're thinking about cooperation both within a country and cooperation across the world, across the nations of the world. And I think if that can be secured, and the political temper of our times is, I fear, not particularly conducive to this, but if that can be secured, I think there's actually a pretty good chance that we can find for everybody workable solutions. And I want actually to end this, my answer to this particular question, by referring to something that we talk about a little bit at the very end of our last dialogue, which is the way in which the Pope has given us a call to environmental action. We're very much on the same page as Pope Francis and the other religious leaders who echoed what he said. We think that at the core of all of this is a kind of foolish consumerism and a foolish materialism that has distracted us from focusing on the things that are most important in our lives and trying to work things out so that our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren and great-great-grandchildren and so on can really enjoy opportunities for doing the kinds of things that matter most to people, having productive lives in sustaining and nurturing communities, developing their talents and so forth. And the focus in so many of these discussions about climate change has been on economic measures. And the economic measures are secondary. They're secondary in that they serve as the basis for attaining the important things, but they aren't substitutes for the important things. And so we agree completely with the Pope and with the other religious leaders who've come out, connecting climate change with the call to focus on what's really important in life.
Well, I'm glad you went to that last chapter. I think we need to jump ahead. I'd like to invite some of my listeners in on this conversation in just a minute. But I do want to go to this idea that you raise in the last chapter, the idea of really requiring a kind of global democratic effort, a global democracy. And I have to say, as I was reading that, I was a bit skeptical about it. It seemed a little bit idealistic and utopian, particularly in the current climate, that anything like that could really be achieved. But I'd like you to try to lay that out a little bit so that our listeners can have some idea of the direction that the two of you are going.
Okay, so we think of democracy as multi-leveled. So there are some issues that arise within a family. And the family, if it's a democratically run family, talks it over and tries to figure out what to do about them. And it would be wrong and intrusive for outsiders to intervene. And there are other issues that concern a neighborhood or a community. And once again, the people involved in that community have to work those out together through democratic discussion and try to figure out how they're going to proceed. And it would be wrong for outsiders to intervene. And you can go up the scale here. You can go to sort of counties and states and you know, groups scattered across a nation and whole nations. But there are some problems that are so big that they require global cooperation. And for that, you need institutions that will do the same kind of democratic work at the global level as you have within the family, within the local community, within the nation state, and so forth. So, I mean, this is just, it seems to us, simply a matter of the logic of democracy, that problems come at different scales. They require collaboration and cooperation among smaller or bigger groups of people. And the right way to pursue those is through democratic discussion at whatever scale is appropriate. So we think of this in terms of, and this is an image we use in the last chapter, and it seems to me right, that our species, and indeed not only our species, but many other species on this planet, currently face a common enemy. And that enemy is the high concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And we suggest thinking of this as a kind of a wartime alliance. Allies have to come together in war, and they have to work together and collaborate and figure out with one another how they're going to defeat the enemy. Well, that's what our whole species now has to do. And to do that requires a kind of egalitarian, respectful, democratic discussion across the nations of the world. And I don't see any, I think neither Evelyn nor I sees any serious alternative to that. And to go back to the beginning of our conversation, so the thought is that we want to see movement from the one-on-one small group conversations in which people work through these issues in a kind of snowballing, growing movement that will eventually lead to international policies, transnational policies that can really make this kind of cooperation work. Because if we don't cooperate, if the United States continues to opt out, if other nations opt out, other nations and blocks of nations opt out of this, then our species is doomed.
Right. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Consider This on KZYX, and if you have a question or comment for Philip Kitcher in this climate change issue, please give us a call at 707-895-2448. My guest is Philip Kitcher. He's co-author of The Seasons Alter, How to Save Our Planet in Six Acts. And I do have a caller coming in. Hi there. You're on the air. May I have your first name, please? If you got to turn your radio off. Since we've got
okay, I did.
Okay, thanks. Go ahead. May I have your first name, please?
Dennis.
Dennis, go ahead.
Well, I'd like to play devil's advocate for a moment, if I may.
Good.
Could it be that in an evolutionary sense, a cosmic evolutionary sense, Earth is destined to be used up and abandoned, and survivable type of mentality or human beings will leave Earth and start settling elsewhere in the cosmos? Mother Earth, mothers are destined to die. Mothers die. They grow old and their resources are drained and they die. Has evolution ever had any ethical or moral aspects to it? It just seems to be a very often a ruthless process that doesn't care about the numbers of people that survive, but the fact that the process keeps going, the evolutionary process, in a cosmic sense.
Great questions, Dennis. I'm going to let Philip answer them. And
okay,
if you'd like
sure.
to listen off the air, that'd be great.
No, but I think that's an excellent question. You're completely right to think that much of what our species has striven for is in direct opposition to the pressures of natural selection. You're completely correct to think that someday the Earth will not be inhabitable by human beings. On the other hand, I think a kind of fatalistic resignation in the face of, so to say, throwing up our hands and saying, oh, well, you know, our species is doomed. We either have to go somewhere else, which is not a feasible option in the next centuries. I highly doubt whether we could colonize any other planet within a span of, say, 400 or 500 years. And in that time, by that time, all the damage will be done. Well, a lot of damage will be done. So that isn't really a serious practical option. So what we then have to think about is whether we're prepared to acquiesce in just our own extinction. And that strikes me as profoundly unethical. I believe that ethics is, in fact, an entirely human affair. It's something that has made us the species that we are, that we have brought it out of our own kind of limited abilities to cooperate with one another. I've written at great length about this. But once we are in the ethical mode, then we owe it to one another, to the people who live now, and to the people who come after us to do something about it. So I think we can neither practically think about going off somewhere else, deserting our planet, and establishing ourselves somewhere else in the cosmos, nor ethically just sit down and let it all go. So that would be my response to your view.
Great.
But you're right. Humanity will one day go extinct. But it seems to me that, to quote Dylan Thomas, we should rage against the dying of the light. That is, we should try to push that off as long as possible. We owe it to the people who now live and to those who will come after us.
Let me take another call here.
You
need to turn off your radio, please, and you're on the air. May I have your first name, please?
Take another call here. You need to turn off your radio, please, and you're on the air. May I have your first name, please?
Going to have to drop that one. There's just too much. If you're coming on the air, let me just remind you, you need to have your radio off. If you're calling us in, you might just have to turn it down so that we don't get that kind of feedback. That person can call back. Hi there. You're on the air. May I have your first name, please?
My name is Bill.
Hi, Bill. Go ahead.
Yeah. Agriculture has been put forth by some as a way to sequester the carbon using more fungal-rich composts and there's some various procedures that can be done, and I think a lot of the population is not farming or gardening and isn't aware of this, but some of the proponents of it think that it will solve the problem alone and we don't really need to reduce burning of fossil fuels, or maybe they don't think that, but they think that it's much bigger impact. I'm not sure. I think we need to do all of the above, but I'm wondering if you considered that and that there's a cumulative sequestering that goes on, and some of the proponents seem to think it will go on forever. I think at some point it will stop because the living portion of the soil can only take so much carbon, but it is significant. So I was wondering if you considered that in the book.
Actually, we don't. We do consider the standard carbon sequestration methods that have been proposed for plants and so forth that burn fossil fuels. We do also talk a bit about the difficulties with standard agricultural practices, which, as you probably know, as things stand, big agriculture is responsible for a significant amount of emissions into the atmosphere.
Yeah.
Some people put it at 10%. Some people would put it at 33% of the emissions into the atmosphere.
You might want to look into David Johnson at the University of the said New Mexico State, Las Cruces. David Johnson has done some work on this, and there's several others too.
Actually, I have, since we finished the book, I have actually looked at some of these sources, and it seems to me that what we say in the book about carbon sequestration in fossil fuel burning plants applies here too. It's good to know that you can do these things on a relatively small scale. The difficulties always come, it seems to me. Actually, this comes with renewable energies as well in scaling things up. I mean, as you probably know, solar panels, wind farms work very nicely for certain kinds of communities. What gets very difficult is when you've got a very large city and very large industrial production with variable needs for energy there. But and so it's actually much of the technology, both for sequestration and for renewable energy sources, poses challenges about scale. And that's what I've so far seen in the work to which you allude. It is promising. I think it's be premature to say that it can solve the problem all by itself. And part of our pragmatism is to, as you put it, do all of the above. So I agree with you completely about that.
Thanks, Bill.
Thanks.
If you've got a comment or question, you're welcome to give us a call at 895-2448. Again, my guest is Philip Kitcher. He's co-author of The Seasons Alter, How to Save Our Planet in Six Acts. One of the other themes that you talk about in the last chapter that seems to be, I've got another call, so I'm going to go ahead and take it.
Good.
Hi there, you're on the air. May I have your first name, please?
Yeah, this is Randy from Willits, and I greatly appreciate the program. I'm coming in late, but I don't know if you've talked about tidal power, energy from the sea. This is a forgotten notion, and I think Small is Beautiful by E.F. Schumacher is critical at this juncture in our history, that everything that's going wrong, it's because it's too big. We have to get back to the village. We have to get back to the town. We have to get back to the families and communities. And I think that if we could figure out how to get fresh water from the ocean, I have a policy of turning bad things into good things, like to the carbon sequestration, all these forest fires. We're getting the timber is burning, and so carbon is in the air when it rains. The soils are getting remineralized. The hurricane that's in Texas right now is refilling the water, underground water aquifers, with fresh water. The Tigris and Euphrates flooded their banks for thousands of years, and it's a deep agricultural history because the siltation and sedimentation enriched the ground with the minerals that they needed to enable the crops to grow.
Randy, I'm an optimist.
I think we can find answers and we can find solutions, but Small is Beautiful. We can't do massive scale. Nuclear power is not the answer. And I would like to get this author's comments on tidal power, energy from the sea. Thank you.
Thanks, Randy.
Okay. So actually there are three things I take in your question. One is, do we consider tidal power? The answer to that is no. We did talk a little bit about along with wind farms and solar panels and geothermal energy, we did talk a bit about hydro sources of energy, but not specifically about tidal power. So that's the first thing I want to say. The second thing you mentioned is desalination. That may well become very, very important, it seems to me. And at the moment, of course, desalination is quite complex. It's expensive. It's economically and energetically expensive. But if we can find ways to, as it were, to fuel clean energy into desalination plants, then that may become a very important part of responding to the droughts that come out of the episodic effects of climate change. So the last thing you said is small is beautiful. We may need to return to the village. It seems to me those are experiments we should try. It's possible to try to figure out how people would live if they tried to live simpler lives, if they took leaves out of Thoreau's book and really tried to simplify everything. But I think those experiments should be pursued in tandem with other experiments which try to make large cities much less sort of energy wasteful than they have been. I mean, you can think of this, of our pragmatic approach, as offering any number of potential experiments. One of them is try to redesign cities, try to make cities work better. Another is give up on cities altogether and try and see to what extent people can engage in satisfying, productive, culturally rich lives in smaller communities. I mean, I think these are two very different kinds of experiments, and we can't tell in advance which one of those will work or which ones of those will work. So I wouldn't be ready to sign on to, you know, small is beautiful, we've got to return to the village as, you know, the dictated solution. But it seems to me that we should try to see what can be preserved in the richness of the human heritage and in the Pope's terms, the things that really matter to us, if we try to scale back and simplify.
I'm going to take another call here. Hi there, you're on the air. May I have your first name, please?
Good morning. First name is Steve.
Hey, Steve, go ahead.
Okay, so I have a comment about considering this. Is a lot of folks seem to think that the problem is really overwhelming. So I've come up with a small solution myself that I'd like to share it with the listeners. What I did was I took $20 and I went down to my local hardware store and I bought solar walk lights. And every morning before I go to work, I put my solar walk lights outside, and every evening when I come home, I bring them inside and I put them on top of my medicine cabinet in my bathroom and I tape the light switch off. And then I put one in my hallway and I tape the light switch off. Now I just am imagining if everyone in Ukiah did that, we wouldn't need a nuclear power plant to produce power because there would be no need for power. So I think the problem may seem overwhelming to most people, but there is something that everyone can do about it. And it's just a small part, but just imagine if everyone in Santa Rosa did that. If everyone in L.A. did that, just think about how small a portion you would have to spend, how much small time you'd have to spend, and you would be teaching your children how we can save the planet and not just look at all the bad parts about it and identify all the problems without having a solution.
Okay, thanks, Steve.
So there are ways in which individual people can save the electric.
Philip, are you there? I think we lost him. Philip, I don't hear you on the air. Maybe we lost the connection. Looks like we have. I'm afraid.